Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable to our program this morning for this 8th day of June. A delight to have you here and to have you with us and to have us with you. How nice. We would like to welcome all of you to join us. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we will get to your letters as soon as we get started and start talking about what's going on in the world today. Before we do all of that, let me introduce the group to you. We'll let you know who's on the panel today, and then we will get going. A lot of good stories and some interesting stories to discuss. They're all interesting, I guess, but we'll you know, some are better than others. Okay, here we go. Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
I'm here. Good morning, Joe.
All right. Is that that's it?
Start.
Okay. Good. All right.
Excellent. Quiet.
reserve this morning. That's okay. We welcome J.P. Miller, the Empire Report's very own. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning. I'm great. Thank you for having me, Joe.
Very nice to have you. Investigative journalist, UAlbany adjunct professor, Rosemary Armeo. Good morning, Rosemary.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
It's wonderful to have you on the program. And, oh, my goodness, look who's here. Mike Spain joins us, former Times Union Associate Editor.
Yay.
Our dear, dear friend. And he has been safely traveling the globe to see his family, and he's finally back and with us in the studio, and we couldn't be more thrilled. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. Happy to be here, Joe.
Yeah.
And happy to see everybody face to face.
So good for you for doing the good grandparent thing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. Finally feel safe enough to fly. You know, JP and I were just talking about it. There's a lot to say about it, but we went to Oregon, Denver, California, you know, to see all the grandkids, and New York City to see all the grandkids. So we're covered.
Excellent. Well, we're very glad to have you back. We missed you, and it just seems like the earth is on its axis when Mike Spain is here. So, well, it's all good.
That's right.
Panel at WAMC.org. If you would like to join us, panel at WAMC.org. Okay, so let's go to the stories in the news today, and a lot of interesting stories that we can talk about. But why don't we start with the idea? We talked about ransomware yesterday. Jim Henler was on and was talking about how the ransomware is, these attacks are hitting everyday aspects of our life, from hospitals and screwing up people's chemotherapy appointments to taking a ferry to Martha's Vineyard. Well, what we learned yesterday is that the U.S., we talked about this, about the Colonial Pipeline and how so much money had been paid them, that it's a ransomware attack. The ransom was paid, but now we learn that the U.S. seized much of the ransom from hackers in the Colonial Pipeline attack. Investigators traced 75 bitcoins worth more than $4 million that the company paid in the attack, which had prompted fuel and shortages and price spikes. The Justice Department then turned the tables on the Russian hacking group, reaching into a digital wallet to snatch back about $2.3 million. So you all think you're pretty fancy with your computers and can shut down our pipelines, but we can go into your digital wallet and pick your pocket. What do you think, Alan?
Cool. I mean, it's cool, of course. There can be retribution, and that's what you worry about. That right now there seems to be a sort of gentleman or gentlewoman's agreement that, you know, we just go along with it. Now somebody says, we're going to take you on with everything we got. Does that mean that these onerous, disgusting, terrible people are going to get have retribution on us for doing that? We'll soon see.
JP.
I have tried to learn as much as I can about Bitcoin over the last months and over a year. And I watched an interview with Stan Druckenmiller, who's one of the smartest hedge fund guys on the planet. Worked for George Soros for 30 years. He's worth a couple billion dollars. I saw an interview with Stan Druckenmiller, and he said, I can't figure out Bitcoin. So I said, if Stan Druckenmiller can't figure out Bitcoin, how am I going to figure it out? And so there are two different things when you hear about Bitcoin. Is one, they say that it is totally transparent. Every transaction, there's a record of it. But then in addition to that, it can also be anonymous. So I don't really understand, one, how they transferred the Bitcoin anonymously, and two, how they actually recovered it. But it does, seeing the story makes me nervous, really, about our energy infrastructure in our country. You know, in my neighborhood up outside of Saratoga Springs, we had a significant power outage last week. And you think about, could they do that to, you know, a state, a region of our country, and how would we deal with that?
Well, and you have these, like, there is an outage, an internet outage that has affected many, many, not the Empire Report, but it's affected many, many huge entities. And then you immediately think, oh, does this have something to do with this? Now, we don't know yet. It's much too early. And I think it's just an outage, right? But it is the first thing you think of in our current state. Rosemary?
Well, like you, JP, I've also tried to figure out what the heck Bitcoin is about. And I've also been inundated, maybe you have too, on social media with people who want to be my friends on Facebook and follow me on Twitter who are really Bitcoin salesmen. And basically what happened here is that they recovered the part of the money that went into the digital wallet of the agent that was doing this, but the company that sold them the malware, that gave them the means to carry out this operation, they still got their money. That was not recovered. That's the difference, most of the difference in the two sums of money between what was asked and what was recovered. And so here's what I think would happen. I did listen to Jim yesterday. He's an acknowledged master on this stuff. And he says, you know, eventually we'll get it down to a bearable crime. And the people who do these operations are smart. They don't want the FBI after them. They don't want the Department of Justice on their tail. So I think they'll adjust their business model. They made a mistake going after something that's considered critical infrastructure. They already have a policy of not going after hospitals, because if you build outrage so enormously, you get the sort of police action that we saw happen now. So I don't think that maybe they'll go after, you know, infrastructure so much anymore. Water plants, however, are
meatpacking plants.
Well, meatpacking is different. You know, that's not critical infrastructure. You can live on carrots for a while.
They can get
money on that, you know.
Right.
So.
And that's what you see them going
yeah,
after.
I think they'll change their business model. It's very interesting. It's good that they're going after them. I don't think Trump understood what was going on, as we don't fully, but nor did he appreciate the threat that this represents. And that's certainly not true under the Biden administration. So you have to be happy about that.
Mike Spain.
Yeah, the story in the Washington Post today didn't say how officials got the key the code to get into the cryptocurrency account and recover it. But NBC News reported last night, essentially, they hacked it. It does give me some hope that the FBI is building competence in going after hackers by using many of the same methods and understanding them. The way we learned how to go after, let's say, you know, people trafficking pornography and child pornography on the internet. I mean, they basically begin to understand the culture of it. They apply resources to it. It's a great area of opportunity for young people who want to go into jobs where they can use the skills that they've got and sit and play in all those games, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's hopeful that, as Jim Hendler said yesterday, that we're going to turn this around and we'll be able to combat it. But I did see that Biden is going to try to talk to Vladimir Putin about it and come to some kind of begin some international dialogue, like we did when we did the nuclear test ban treaty, 50 years ago. And I think that it's in every country's interest, because every country is vulnerable to this kind of thing.
Let's see. We have some letters here. Steven says, weren't cryptocurrencies supposed to be crypto?
the owner who's doing the actual transactions is not knowable, but the transaction itself, money moving from one place to another, is all recorded. That's the transparent part. That's how the FBI figured out what wallet this was likely moving into. There was a suspicious movement of exactly the right amount of money into there. But Rosemary,
for those of us who are a little slow, could you explain what the word wallet means?
Well, it's a metaphor. It's a place on the internet where money is moved. So it's
or
like
documents.
Or documents. Yeah. True. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's so because it's money, they call it a wallet. And anybody who does online banking knows what this is like. You know, they don't really move your money from one place to another. It's all done electronically. But the metaphor is I'm putting money into a wallet to pay you, and then I take out the money when I'm getting the payment.
And if the FBI was able to figure out where this cryptocurrency was moved to or what the cryptocurrency was, are they also able to do that with drug dealers and other organized crime? Or was this kind of a special circumstance because it was such a big news story and a threat to the country's security?
That's a good question.
Well, that's what Mike is saying. It's good that they're developing, the FBI and other officials are developing expertise in this, because yes, organized crime is oh so much easier when you have Bitcoin. There's no exchange of money. You never have to show yourself. So in order to find these guys, you've got to be able to hack in.
But the risk is that the market is volatile. You might have ransom of $5 million,
right,
and by the time you get your hands on it, it's only worth $1 million. The way Bitcoin goes up and down like that, it's very risky.
You know,
except it's going up and up.
It goes down too. I mean, there's corrections.
Yeah, even this amount, there's some variation because of the value. The value was more when the ransom was paid than it is now. But the trend overall is up, and organized criminals are pretty damn smart, and they keep using this, and that means it builds a market for it, and it is going to go up. So,
but the future of Bitcoin is in question because it takes up so much energy to create Bitcoin mine, quote unquote.
Bitcoin mining.
Bitcoin mining takes an enormous amount of electricity, and it's very anti-green. And there's places that are, you know, clamping down on the ability of these companies to put server farms in that just hunt after long, 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 long numbers that are unique. And that's what Bitcoin is. It's like a rare number so rare that you own it and you can trade it. But it's still very confusing.
We sound like we know what we're talking
about.
Yeah,
it's very confusing.
But you mentioned the salespeople, but you see all this stuff online, and there's all these charts and graphs, and I look at it and I said, oh, okay. You know, you see an arrow going up, and you go, all right, I get that. I understand that, but that's about all I understand of it.
Yeah, I think they want you to not understand, but trust them. You know, they're trying to build trust. Mm-hmm. You can make a lot of money. Just come with us. It's a scam.
Get it on it.
Yeah.
And where does Elon Musk fit into all that?
He trades in that, and then he goes on Saturday Night Live and made basically a pitch for Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Like he's made
but,
money.
But then
on
he's
this.
Backed down.
He has.
Yeah,
he
he's
has,
saying he's moving so away from Bitcoin, and Tesla may no longer accept Bitcoin.
He was he has. That's true.
The tough thing with Bitcoin is when one invests in it, the real thing that you're investing is this belief that it's going to appreciate and hold value over time. And
it's
when it goes down, where is that belief? You know, if I go and buy Goldman Sachs stock or Facebook stock or Google stock and it goes down, you usually can go to the news and say, okay, it's down 20%. Here's why. There is some event with the business as to why it's going down. With Bitcoin, with cryptocurrency, it's tough to okay, you know, Elon Musk tweets out, I don't like Bitcoin anymore. And you lose 30% of your money because of one of Elon Musk's tweets. That's tough, I think. Tougher than Goldman Sachs earnings going down or whatever company's stock that you hold that is an explainable event to help you re-underwrite your investment thesis.
That's called high-stakes gambling, and there's never been a lack of market for that.
Right.
No.
You need a lot of money to play that game.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have many letters on this. We'll go to other subjects as well. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, J.P. Miller, and Mike Spain make up our panel this morning. We welcome your letters. All you have to do is write to us. We ask that you keep them short and to the point and pre-read them so that they make sense. That's really helpful to us. and you can send them to panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll have a couple of messages and then go to news to the BBC, and then we'll be back with more. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Lots of letters about what we were talking about before, which was Bitcoin and the ransomware attack and dot, dot, dot. So we go to Roland, who says, let us not forget the hack of Colonial did not attack the actual delivery systems. It attacked their billing system. They chose to not deliver fuel.
That's interesting. I wasn't quite aware of that nuance, but at least it didn't break down how the gasoline and fuel was distributed, which would have been more detrimental.
Yeah, and thankfully it didn't have, you know, any effect on the pumps. That's good. Deborah says, not only is it confusing, like Madoff without access to actual records, seems potential for scam as well as nefarious enterprises, but it also requires huge amounts of electricity. As you mentioned, China is smart to crack down on it. This from Bob. I'm a Bitcoin owner because I believe that it will appreciate greatly over the long run. People who need short-term gains should not consider Bitcoin as a viable investment. However, Mike is wrong about Bitcoin being only an investment for rich people. Anyone can buy tiny pieces of Bitcoin at a time and get into the game.
Well, that's what Rosemary says she gets on Facebook, people offering to sell Bitcoin and get you in on it, except that if you don't have much to risk, if you know, that's fine. But if you have things to risk, should you really be investing in something that is volatile?
First one's free. Bob says, Alan, I love you, but Alan, I love you, but it's naive to talk about being afraid of retribution from hackers, even if we don't retrieve the money. They fully expect to attack again anyways. They are thieves. They never stop scheming.
Well, there are lots of ways to parse this. He's probably right. You don't want to be afraid of a crook or you know, blackmailer getting even worse. On the other hand, at some point you really have to crack down, and I'm for that. But you know, the accusation is that I'm naive, to which I absolutely plead guilty.
Kevin writes, can't help but hear that the cyber attack on the pipeline was traced back to Russia. Am I crazy thinking that Trump could benefit without even asking for their help? Rising gas prices would be politically beneficial for the midterms. How conspiratorial do we want to get this morning? Anybody?
Well, I mean, the news really forces you to be conspiratorial because the Republicans have adopted conspiracy as a modus operandi, and we can't overestimate that. Yeah, I think it's possible.
All right, let's move on to other topics and go to the other issues on our plate this morning. I think I accidentally... There we go. So we talked about this story too, as far as the Vice President of the United States going to Guatemala yesterday, and we prefaced that we were previewing that story because she had not yet landed when we talked about it. But what she said yesterday was, "Do not come." That was Vice President Harris's remarks in Guatemala, detailing efforts to curb migration. It was her first foreign trip as vice president. Kamala Harris said the U.S. would bolster investigations into corruption and human trafficking in Guatemala while also delivering a clear, blunt message to undocumented migrants hoping to reach the United States, do not come. Ms. Harris issued the warning during a trip that was an early yet pivotal test for a vice president currently tasked with the complex challenge of breaking a cycle of migration from Central America by investing in a region plagued by corruption, violence, and poverty. While President Biden campaigned on unwinding some of the Trump administration's border restrictions, allowing migrants to apply for asylum at the U.S. border, Ms. Harris amplified the White House's current stance that most of those who cross the border would be turned away and would instead need to find legal pathways or protection closer to their home countries. Alan.
Well, we've got two very good lawyers on our panel during the week who represent people who are trying to get into the country. I think as somebody who we expect may be president and will probably be president, Harris is correct to take a fairly tough line. You can't let everybody in. Before you dial and say, Alan, of course you can let everybody in. You can't. And on the other hand, you got to figure out how to do it in such a way as that the people we need get in legally and get here. So she's got a balance, and I applaud her for what she said, although there will be those who do not.
I am one of those.
Okay, go.
Okay, so I was bursting to talk in yesterday's panel when you were all extolling Kamala Harris and saying that the only people who could criticize her were those who are against a black woman. I am not against a black woman. I want her to be president.
Wait, wait,
but
you
I think
we
this
said
is
that?
Yes, you did.
You
yes,
think we,
I took
wait,
notes
wait, wait,
on
wait.
That.
Be very careful.
No,
be
you guys did that. It wasn't you. It was,
no, no.
It was the other panelist who said that. Libby and the other lawyer said yes.
Sienna.
Mm-hmm. And so I would like to say that I think this is nothing but window dressing, and it cannot work. For this policy, which they've adopted, which I think is a good one, that you attack the root causes of immigration, you are looking at best, a 10-year window before it can work. It's not going to be solved, not tomorrow, not even if there are two Biden-Harris administrations will this problem be solved. And so they send one person, and it is a PR effect because she cannot do anything by herself. Even if she were president, she could not do anything by herself. There's nobody from the Department of Justice who actually could pursue cases against corruption involving Guatemala and the United States. No one from the Congress who could go in and actually make laws to change immigration and make real changes that would last, that would move forward. And even the money she had, $4 billion, is a pittance. It's window dressing. And we're saying, oh, this is great. She's wonderful. I love her. She did give a great speech and all that, but it means nothing.
But wait, should she not have, Rosemary, let me just get this straight. Should she not have said, don't come?
I don't care what she said about that. I think that it doesn't mean anything. People are going to come, as she herself said, because they cannot get their basic needs met in the country where they're from or because they're in danger. So the vice president of the United States going there on a PR ploy saying don't come means nothing. It has no effect. It doesn't matter whether she says it or not. What I want from Biden and Harris is real action. If they had sent a team down, if they said we have a policy, here's what we're going to do, here's how we're going to push it forward in the future, I would be applauding the hell out of it. But to send one charismatic politician, an American politician, into Central America, she has no special clout there. What does it all mean? Isn't it more just of the same, just the kind of political window dressing that makes people sick of politics?
Well, wait one second. Isn't she the voice of the American government, the number two person? She goes and she says, don't come. That then we can ascribe to Biden that this is policy, because you know there are an awful lot of people who lined up at the borders, Rosemary, who really believe that Biden wants to let everybody in, and here the Vice President of the United States goes and says, "Don't come." Well, I mean, I hear everything you're saying, but on the other hand, I think it's an announcement of policy.
I had my say. I'm going to let go.
Yeah,
ahead,
no, I just wanted to dovetail on what Rosemary was saying. It is the right thing to do. I mean, the reason we have this situation in Central America is because of decades of U.S. foreign policy that favored the U.S. and kept dictators propped up in the governments down there because it was all favorable to the U.S. You can't go in and flip the switch, but you do have to begin. And Harris going down there and confronting a fairly corrupt Guatemalan president. I mean, back in 2019, he kicked a UN panel out of Guatemala that was trying to fight corruption. He's no stalwart of democracy by any means. But to confront him, in person on his turf, I think is a bold step. As Rosemary said, though, the real proof will be in the follow-up. Will we follow through with it? And every foreign leader now knows all around the globe, mm-hmm. whatever the U.S. says they're going to do, we know it'll last maybe 3 years because then there'll be an election and it could flip overnight and we'll just wait and see. And we need to make foreign policy, you know, stop politicizing outside of U.S., the U.S. border. And this is the destruction of what happened between 2016 and 2020 with our foreign policy.
JP.
Boy, so much to think about on this one. A big result of what's happening now is when, I believe, on Biden's first day in office, they signed executive orders loosening border restrictions and basically gave notice to those in Central and South America that the doors were open. And as they talk to people that are coming over the border, that's what they say. And now it has gone from, you know, first day in office, we're loosening border restrictions, to now the vice president of the United States says, do not come, which, you know, we used to say, you know, on the campaign trail, they were saying, bring us, you're tired and you're poor. And now there's a new message, which is do not come. Another thing that I think about is Tom Friedman in the New York Times. Progressive Tom Friedman of the New York Times wrote an op-ed a couple weeks ago saying the United States needs to build a big wall with a big door and let in a lot of people, because the truth is we need these immigrants. We need hundreds of thousands of new immigrants every year. This is really a symptom of I see a government that hasn't been able to come up with comprehensive immigration reform when we've needed it, you know, for 20 years. Why is that? It is one of the most controversial issues. You can see people on the left and the right are totally at opposite ends of the spectrum. This is a very important issue for blue-collar workers in swing states. And so I've given you this whole jumble. We basically have a mess, and it's not an easy fix for President Biden.
Good analysis.
Yeah, no, I think your point is well made. And Tom Friedman was talking about, I believe, a metaphorical wall, not so much a physical wall. But the point is good. We do need immigrants. And population experts say that the U.S. population will start to go down by mid-century, if not sooner. And we'll be paying bonuses to Central American immigrants to come into the U.S. and setting them up at that point. And why can't we just move in the right direction and allow people to go back and forth legally? If a lot of immigrants would go back and forth legally, and we'd have a much better situation if we weren't so frightened of people from other countries who we've been told are murderers and rapists, when actually the number of, you know, the percentage of people who are immigrants who are criminals is far lower than the percentage of people who are already here.
Alan, any thoughts?
No, I'm listening with bated breath.
Breath in the ears, I get it. All right, we'll take a break. We'll get to letters when we come back. When we do, we will go on to these letters, but also other topics as well. Panel at WAMC.org, and we'll be right back.
Support for
Good morning. Welcome back to our roundtable discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, JP Miller, and Mike Spain. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Letters on this and other topics that we discussed this morning. Brian writes, telling people from South America not to come is akin to telling someone drowning not to reach for the life preserver. Not highly effective. We go to, Kathleen, I bought Grayscale Bitcoin Trust via Schwab. Huge appreciation over the years, last few years. You can invest as little as you like. I am a buy and hold person. This can be for anyone. All right. And Tim says, regarding the recent computer hacks, I like to believe that with all of the technology, including the internet itself, having been developed in this country, that the USA can make the lights in Moscow blink at will.
Hmm.
Anyone on that? All right. No? Okay. All right. Let's move on to, what'd you say?
I said, I don't know. I mean, you like to think that, but we believe in the myth of American is exceptionalism. It seems to me that Russia's doing the light blinking.
It's all those rocket scientists and, you know, they know how to do that stuff.
Let's go to the story on, I want to do election fraud and ballot reviews in a few minutes, so we'll get to that. This letter just came in from on immigration. Allison writes, wanted to add that the agricultural sector in which I work already depends on immigrant labor. We need 3-year renewable visas. It is impossible to get those for small businesses. Not all agricultural work is seasonal.
One other point on that is you go to any restaurant around the entire state, it seems like there are help wanted signs on every single restaurant. Those people could start as restaurant workers. Their kids get education. They can all achieve the American dream. Maybe not all of them, but a lot of them.
All right, let's go to so I want to get into election fraud and that story. And there's a lot of aspects to that story. So I'll do it after the top of the hour. So let's go to the FDA and the approval of the Alzheimer's drug. This is a really interesting story because there seems to be a great debate over whether the drug actually works. So, and I don't even mean this to be smart alecky, but I thought that was sort of one of the reasons of why you approve something is that, like when you put something up for approval, that one of the things you had to show is that
it works.
It works. Well, okay.
Maybe one of the main things.
Yes, you would. So Aduhelm, is that the, I believe, the name of the the drug, is the first new Alzheimer's treatment in 18 years and the first to attack the disease process. But some experts say there's not enough evidence that it can address cognitive symptoms. But the Food and Drug Administration on Monday approved the new medication for Alzheimer's disease. It was a contentious decision made despite opposition from the agency's independent advisory committee and some Alzheimer's experts who said there was not enough evidence that the drug can actually help patients. The drug, which will go by the name Aduhelm, is a monthly intravenous infusion intended to slow cognitive decline in people with mild memory and thinking problems. It is the first approved treatment to attack the disease process of Alzheimer's instead of just addressing the symptoms. Biogen, its manufacturer, announced Monday afternoon that the list price would be $56,000 a year. In addition, there will most likely be tens of thousands of dollars in costs for diagnostic testing and brain imaging. Recognizing that clinical trials of the drug had provided incomplete evidence to demonstrate effectiveness, the FDA granted approval for the drug to be used but required Biogen to conduct a new clinical trial. Alan.
Well, you know, Joe, I have a relative who has serious Alzheimer's. And, you know, I've been following this quite closely. And one of the things that this drug apparently does, I'm sure somebody will correct me if I'm wrong, is to minimize the amount of plaque that's in the brain.
Right.
And that has been studied for years now. This is nothing new, and it has been found not to be effective. So then the question becomes, what's the politics of this situation that the FDA feels it has to do something despite the fact that we have some real evidence that it won't work?
Yeah, and on the other side, you had patient advocacy groups who lobbied really hard for approval because there are so few treatments available for Alzheimer's. So that was sort of the other side of the coin. Some other drugs and clinical trials are more promising, but they are most likely 3 or 4 years away from potential approval, according to scientists. Rosemary.
Well, the politics, I think, are that patient advocacy groups put huge pressure on the FDC to come through with this. There have been no new Alzheimer's drugs since 2003, and anybody who's dealt with it knows it is a really scary, horrible, awful disease. And to be told by a doctor, well, your mother, your loved one has this, there's nothing you can do about it, it's awful. And so, of course, you want to give them something and hope that it'll have an effect. Maybe even see an effect when there isn't anything there. So hence the pressure to come out with a new drug. But that's why we have the FDA. I mean, snake oil salesmen used to do a great business because people wanted to feel better, so they would buy worthless medicines. That's why we have the FDC, to keep this away, to keep this off the market. And instead now, Biogen, which is the manufacturer of this drug, they saw an immediate increase in their stock price. A lot of resources and money are going to a company that may be working on a drug that doesn't work. How about putting money instead, research and development money, into the other pharma companies that are looking at that are looking at drugs with more promise. And the other thing is that on paper, it looks fine. The FDC said yes, but we'll say okay, but you have to do a further test. But the FDC has a record of not doing anything about those FDA.
No, that's okay.
Of not doing a follow-up on those tests. So if results continue to be negative, there's no guarantee that the federal government will pull back approval of this drug.
So I think to myself as I was reading this yesterday, oh, well, that doesn't seem to make sense that we're testing it while we're administering it.
Right.
But by the same token, if I were really upset about that, then I would be upset about what they're doing, what they did with the COVID vaccine, which is essentially the same thing, right?
I don't think so.
The immediate and very positive results of COVID testing, of the trials for COVID, were so outstanding that it's very different than that. What I compare it to is back in the 1980s.
There's still a lot we don't know about that vaccine.
Oh, there is, but considering the threat and considering this is the COVID vaccine and considering the performance of it, the problems have been statistically minuscule. But this Alzheimer's disease reminds me more of the controversy in the 80s when AIDS was happening and exploding in certain populations. And the FDA did not want to approve anything. The ACT UP people went crazy and they said, look, we're going to die anyway. Let us try something. It might have terrible side effects. It might be horribly expensive, but we've got to go somewhere. And that's when Anthony Fauci kind of flipped on that and did start working with Larry Kramer of ACT UP. And they started approving these drugs that were only tentatively working and are only getting some success, not widespread success. But now, you know, 50 years or 40 years later, there are many, many, many effective drugs. This could be the beginning of that. And I think that's what people are hoping for. You say it has bad results, the preliminary studies, but it did have some positive. It may work with some people, according to these studies, maybe not the majority, and it's terribly expensive. But people who are desperate for a solution to Alzheimer's want something. They want to be moving in some direction and feel that this is the right way to go.
So where do you draw the line then? Why have a federal drug agency at all? What about cancer? People are going to die of cancer either.
Right. And there's always pressure to approve these experimental cancer treatments. Mm-hmm. And if you're facing a failed disease or somebody you love is facing a failed disease, you want to try anything you can. And they did break down in the 80s and allow these experimental AIDS cocktails. You remember these cocktails that went against HIV. And eventually, now it's a pill you take and you don't have to worry about it. I mean, it took a long time. People are hoping there'll be a pill that will just kind of clean the plaque the way that we take a statin to clean out our arteries. And that may come. Some see this as a step in that right direction.
I don't know, Mike. I just want to say that, as I say, I've been following this. And the big hope was that cleaning out the plaque was going to make the difference. It doesn't. That's what's interesting. Yeah.
The cognitive disabilities continue even when the plaque is reduced.
But some individuals in this trial claim that it has actually improved their cognitive abilities. They could be wrong, but there is a debate, and I do agree that not everybody who took the trial or participated in the trials had the benefits that a smaller percentage had. But if people are desperate for something, I understand it more than I'm saying I'm in favor of it. I understand why people pushed for it.
Sure.
And you got to start somewhere. One of the problems for me is that it's so horribly expensive.
I know.
It's going to, and that underscores why we should have prescription drug reform. I mean, the Medicare should be able to negotiate one price for everybody, and Congress keeps that from happening. If that could happen, maybe it would be more affordable and it may be more practical as a path to something that's
Mike,
more
effective.
Mike,
that's another aspect you bring up. Most people who have Alzheimer are old, which means they're on Medicare, which means that this $56,000 a year prescription will be paying for that, which means the whole cost of Medicare
so
goes
the,
up.
So that, right, and that money and could be going to maybe something more effective.
Exactly.
But where do you draw that line? And what is $36,000 acceptable? Is $26,000 acceptable? I mean, we have this dilemma, and we're trying to find a solution or at least a path to fighting Alzheimer's.
And how do we come up with these amazing revolutionary breakthrough drugs like the COVID vaccine, like this potential Alzheimer's? We fund that research through our prescription drug prices. You know, that research is done, and those companies put up the cost of that research ahead of time, and they dig 50 dry wells before they hit oil. Mm-hmm. So
that's not always true.
Yeah, that's
in other words, JP. We know that the basic science that the drug companies use. I agree that, you know, they in the end have to refine it, but the basic science comes from the federal government.
All right, we have to take a break. We are very late, so let's do that. When we come back, we'll continue. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.
Support for WAMC comes from Audiologic Solutions, Rensselaer, Hudson, and Glens Falls.
Katrina and the Waves, Walking on Sunshine, 1985. Hits of yesterday and today. Nice music version of that. Good to hear. Welcome, everyone. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We have a great group this morning. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, J.P. Miller, and Mike Spain. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Let me get to some letters on a bunch of different issues, and then we'll move on to other stuff. Andy says taxpayers shouldn't pay for a drug that is marginally effective with powerful side effects when there is not universal health care for all. We go to anyone on that?
Agree.
It's a good point.
All right. We go to Nancy. U.S. policy, this is about the Harris Strip. U.S. policy going back many decades, including the overthrowing of democratically elected governments, has created the mess that is our immigration system in relationship with countries south of the border. Rosemary might love Kamala Harris, but she is not in the majority. Sending the unpopular Kamala to deliver the horrendous message she gave isn't going to improve the immigration situation or popular support for whatever the administration has planned. I didn't know she was unpopular.
No, I thought I agree with
she
Rosemary.
Won.
Yeah.
Yeah, she won. I think she's great, but this is an assignment that she just doesn't have the power to carry out.
Yeah, you wonder if they set her up a little bit to, you know, let her kind of show her stuff or not, you know, if it's a test that the Democrats maybe are putting on for a potential future president.
But, Alan, aren't we being a little hypocritical when we say, you know, for years and years we just said, well, basically the vice president is to send out to go to funerals and do the stuff that the vice president or that the president doesn't want to do. And, you know, you send him out to a funeral, you send him out to a factory opening, and that's about it. And then when you give them more responsibility in the case of Kamala Harris, then they come under fire for that as well.
Well, I don't see why it's hypocritical, but I do think it's political. And I do think that Biden knows that he has a responsibility here. We've heard from those who think that if she is dismissed without anything to do, that it will be condescending on Biden's part. So I think sending her out, giving her the tough, tough jobs to do, because, by the way, she's asking for them, is the way that you prepare her and you prepare for her to be president of the United States.
Well, I think there's a balance between giving her a tough job to do and giving her an impossible assignment, and to give her both fixed voting rights and then also we have this problem in Latin America that's been there for 50 years. Solve that, too. I've said it before. It reminds me of what Trump was putting on Jared Kushner. It's impossible for one person to do that. She could make inroads. She could work with others, but we're not seeing that. No, we're seeing her go out and make, you know, give speeches. Nice. It's her. The emphasis is on her, not on American policy and what we're doing.
But she asked for the assignment, number one. Number two, if she's president of the United States, and she well may be, then she's going to have all of those things on her plate anyway. So, I mean, I don't think we can argue that she's got too much based on the fact that, you know, she's preparing to be president.
I can totally argue she has too much on her plate. If we're not 3 years, we're not even 1 year into the administration, she is still a rank beginner.
So is the president, does Biden have too much on his plate?
No, he's got 30 years of experience on juggling. She does not.
Well, she was a major senator. She's very, very bright. She was a district attorney who really was able to mobilize an awful lot of other district attorneys. I think she's very bright, and I think that we have to respect her wishes. And if her wishes are that she get these tough assignments, I think she ought to get them.
I think you also have to look at the calendar and say, you know, where are the legislative accomplishments? You know, presidents historically get a lot done in their first 100 days because they get their quote-unquote honeymoon. And other than the, you know, the stimulus, there hasn't been any legislative accomplishments for this White House. We're now in June of the first year. And come November of the first year of this year, we're going to be 1 year away from the midterm elections, and then it's election season. So I look at this White House, I think that they need to start putting some legislative points up on the board as soon as possible. Whether they are big wins or small wins, they need to have some victories to point to in the midterms for them to try and hold the Senate and House.
We got this from Jeffrey.
Wait.
Go ahead.
But 1 second. But JP, they have a couple of major victories in terms of, you know, Biden wins that they can point to, don't they? In terms of the two
the
major bills
stimulus.
Allocated.
Them.
Yeah.
Stimulus?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think Nancy Pelosi and Trump passed two of those last year as well, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, not the ones that Biden has just passed. No.
The Biden ones are better.
They're bigger.
Yes, they certainly are, and they go to where they ought to be going, not to the richest taxpayers in America. JP.
Republicans are saying there's too much money, and you should spread the money into something like infrastructure. Yeah. So that's well, JP's point is that they have not passed enough to win them overwhelming approval from the American population.
Well, you know, it gets very messy because there is so much gerrymandering that is going on in state legislatures and in terms of the formation of congressional districts that one can argue that even if he's done a lot, and I think he has, then how do you, you know, what's the justification for saying that he hasn't done anything? I mean, he's done these major bills. Trump, on the other hand, you know, was the rich taxpayer's friend. You know, I don't get it.
Well, no, I mean, I looked down the line. Has there been any legislation on energy? Has there been any legislation on climate change? Has there been any legislation on education? Has there been any legislation on immigration? Has there been any legislation on infrastructure? And so so you go down the list. And you take
successful legislation.
Yeah,
there's
yes.
a lot of climate change and a lot of education and a lot of fundamental societal improvements.
Executive orders
are buried in the giant infrastructure bill, but that has stalled.
Right.
So there's
no infrastructure bill, and you see the president who was a senator for a long time. You know, he was a senator for 60 or 70 years,
and that's a little exaggeration, but I get it.
130.
What were his big legislative accomplishments during that time? I beseech someone to point that out. And so you get
Clarence Thomas is one.
Right.
crime bill.
So right, the crime bill, which he now denounces, but you're getting to a point now in June where if I were Joe Biden, I would want this infrastructure bill done no matter what. I would figure out a way to get enough senators to vote for this infrastructure bill. It's what his priority has been. Mm-hmm. I think he needs a legislative accomplishment going into the midterms.
And how does he do that without Manchin?
I don't know. It's hard to pass legislation if you can't even get all the senators in your own party to vote for it.
Means there's one person, there's one guy who wants to hold on to his office and do anything he can in order to do it. People are furious at him. My friends are furious at him. But in the end, he's thinking about himself.
Yeah, Manchin has not said he absolutely won't pass an infrastructure bill. He's Biden is going to have to pare it down to make Manchin happy and also some Republicans even. And he can get through an infrastructure bill. The voting rights bill, which is arguably more important, that one I don't see hope for that.
No.
Not until after the midterm elections and a Democratic surge, which I hope will happen.
Well, even with Manchin, that would have been a hard
challenge.
Well, he would have to have changed the filibuster with regard to voting rights bills,
right.
And he's not interested in doing that.
Right.
Yeah, it isn't just him. Cinnamon woman. Right. Cinnamon. Like it is. Yeah.
Cinema. From Arizona.
All right. Let's go to some more letters here. Kevin says, regarding the previous letter writer, just because Ms. Harris is unpopular in Fox News does not mean she is unpopular with the American people. Mark says, it is not true that drug companies fund the research into new drugs. Most drug research is funded by research grants from the federal government, with drug companies getting involved in later marketing and final studies. The drug companies have created a myth that they need the prices so high to recoup their expenses.
I think I said something like that before, Joe, when I talked about the government agencies and the scientific community and the government creating this, and then what happens to the drug companies come along and they put the lipstick on the pig.
Right. Chris writes, there is more study and anecdotal evidence out there in the last few years about the efficacy of coconut oil with dementia and Alzheimer's than this new drug has. And a couple of $5 jars beats $56,000 in my book. Just saying, need we say it again, the health care for all and curb on big pharma, that's critical to aging America.
Wait, I didn't hear about coconut oil.
I do not know.
It's on the internet, Rosemary.
Yeah, I'll check that out.
Jeffrey says, I agree with Rosemary for a change. It's meaningless for Kamala Harris to be in Guatemala trying to appeal to Central American countries and those citizens fleeing the U.S., and I think it's damaging to the possibility of a future would-be presidential run for Ms. Harris. She spewed rhetoric there yesterday that will gain no traction and only be used by the right to show how ineffective she will be as a leader, which makes me wonder why she was assigned this unenviable task in the first place. Migration is going to continue and probably get worse as the effects of global warming, climate change get more intense around the planet and even with the United States. We better get used to it and prepare because the crisis is only going to get worse. That from Jeffrey. Mike.
I didn't hear anything after for a change.
I'll send you the transcript. Mike says, imagine calling Thomas Friedman a progressive and then describing his op-ed where he calls for a big metaphysical wall at our southern border with a shiny door for the quote-unquote right people to gain entrance to our country so they can fill the most laborious jobs for starvation wages. At least someone on the panel accurately identified the root problem underlying the awful condition in Central America. Cold War era American imperialism.
Yep.
All right.
Tom Friedman didn't call for a wall. He didn't say a wall.
I think it was metaphor. You know, we have to have a wall, but a big door. You know.
He said a wall. How is it metaphorical?
Right, but he hasn't favored the concrete and steel wall.
Well, maybe not concrete, but it might some be, kind it of might a wall. Be a, he said we need a wall.
Border, he was, you know, was electronic really, surveillance, drones.
I don't get it. Electronic surveillance. He said we need a wall. I don't understand.
Saying, what, are you taking him literally as he
well,
says
he's,
it?
He's a New York Times columnist.
Is he a liberal or moderate?
That I, was, would say
I think
he's
that's what the
no.
writer.
He's not progressive.
Yeah. He's Ken.
I would.
Can
I wouldn't
be
call
pretty...
him. A, I wouldn't call him a Trump lover. He's not like a Trump. Like a build the wall.
Not
Trump
at all.
Guy. No.
Not at all. Yeah.
I thought he said build the wall. I thought it was part of the headline.
He said we need a wall, but a great big door.
Yeah. So
and
I took that as metaphorical.
I don't get how it's metaphorical.
All right, Alan.
Reading comprehension
the great big door,
classes.
What he was saying, he wasn't talking about building a wall.
It was the whole op-ed about the wall.
I just want to finish. Hey, JP,
okay, Joe's clicking away. We'll get an answer.
I just want to finish the sentence, and that is, what he was saying is, we have to let people in who can be helpful to this country. That's what he was saying. It was very little to do with a wall. Maybe that was a mistake to even put it that way.
I think he wanted more than one door, too, you know.
Well, he said a big door. Yes. Yeah.
After reading as much as I can about the latest surge in illegal immigration along our southern border, this dated April 13th, 2021, Thomas Friedman writes in the New York Times, after reading as much as I can about the latest surge in illegal immigration along our southern border, I'm still not clear how much is seasonal, how much is triggered by President Biden's announcement that he will be halting construction of Donald Trump's border wall and reviewing Trump's asylum policies, and how much is just the lure of jobs in a rapidly vaccinating United States. But this latest flood of illegal immigrants and asylum seekers, more than 170,000 apprehended in March alone, including thousands of children mostly fleeing chaos in Central America, only reinforces my view that the right border policy is a high wall with a big gate.
Yeah, the big gate was a metaphor. Why wasn't the wall a metaphor?
If we just emphasize the high wall and wear cruelty as a badge of honor, as Trump did, we lose out on the huge benefits of immigration. But if we do is focus, as many do on the left, on the evils of a wall and ignore the principles of a big gate, that would be immigrants and asylum seekers need to get in line, ring our doorbell, and enter legally. And those who don't should be quickly evicted. We will also lose out on the huge benefits of immigration.
Yeah, metaphorical.
Okay. With that, we go to good to see you all fired up on that, though, JP. That was fun.
What was the headline, though? What is the headline?
Yeah, you're right.
As any reporter will often write the headline.
We need a high wall. With a big gate on the southern border. That is the headline of the opinion piece. 10 points for Gryffindor. Okay. We go to Dennis, someone just talked about the U.S. supporting dictators in South America, impoverishing those nations over decades because it was good for the U.S. at the time. I'm curious whether anyone sees a parallel in our allowing in all of the world's best and brightest over a similar period.
Allowing the world's best and brightest to come to the U.S.,
yes.
You mean? Oh, sure.
I assume that's what they mean.
I think every country wants to be selective, and they want the best, the brightest, the wealthiest to come in and have a positive impact. But in reality, history will tell you, my people came here and they were very, very poor. You know, Irish came here, Italians came here, Poles came here, people from all over Europe came here, and they began new lives. And that's, I think, what built this country. There's every bit of evidence that Hispanic people are doing the same, and yet we keep putting them down and saying, you know, they're the lower class. They can work in restaurants. They're going to be the bosses of the Irish, the Polish, and the Italian descendants many times, and that's because that's what happens in the U.S. We all become Americans. We're not those nationalities firsthand. We're Americans. And that's the beauty of it.
You see the bias with Syrian refugees from the Middle East who are doctors and lawyers very distinguished professional people. And we won't let them in.
Right. We have doctors driving cabs in New York City because they can't. They can't get certified.
You know, the United States grew without any immigration laws for much of its history and did very well. And then you start regulating it, and the biases show even more. The bias, of course, is what brought about, we need to regulate this. It's so dangerous. It wasn't up until that time. We let everybody in
until the early 60s.
Right. Yeah, and I'm not for open borders. Yeah. Okay, I would like to keep out criminals and people who have horrible diseases.
How big do you want the gate to be?
I want a really big gate. Okay. That Friedman's a progressive genius.
All right. We only have a few minutes before we have to go to the bottom of the hour break. So I'll introduce this story. We can get some quick comment on it, and then we'll move on it when we return. That is the Wall Street Journal exclusive about federal prosecutors' subpoena material related to Andrew Cuomo's book. State officials who edited early versions of New York governor's memoir were among those receiving requests for information. JP has this right at the top of the Empire Report this morning. Prosecutors working for the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Eastern District of New York and Brooklyn asked for communications related to Mr. Cuomo's October 2020 book, American Crisis, including contracts and materials used to pitch the book to publishers, the people said. They also said the subpoenas indicated prosecutors are interested in nursing home issues in the book, which more broadly recounted the governor's response to the pandemic. The demands were included in subpoenas sent last month to individuals who were involved in editing early versions of the book, including state officials. Alan.
This is the federal government, folks. And when the federal government is, you know, run by a Democrat, which it is, there's dark music playing in the background for Andrew. I don't think there's any question about it. You know, when those guys want you, when the FBI wants you, and when the federal grand juries want you, you know, that could be a problem, a real problem.
Mike.
What would the crime be if it's found out that Andrew Cuomo did indeed act to suppress important public health information like the number of nursing home cases of COVID and suppressed it so that he could benefit monetarily by the production and sale of a book and then used people on his staff to do all the work for the book? What are the crimes? I know that's wrong. I just don't know what crime.
We know there's a crime. The crime is that there is a statute that says you cannot, if you are a state employee, use other employees or people who work for you. There is a statute that says that. And that would, of course, be very dangerous for Andrew because, you know, I mean, I suspect he probably got a little help.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk more about the story, have the rest of the panel chime in as well. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, J.P. Miller, and Mike Spain. We were just before the break. We were talking about the story about about federal prosecutors subpoenaing material related to Andrew Cuomo's book. I believe, from my records, both Alan and Mike have weighed in. J.P.
I agree with Alan and Mike, and I also question where was the law broken in the Cuomo scandals? Of course, not reporting the nursing home deaths was a political failure and not a smart move. But was that a crime? I was reminded over the break. I think that the feds are probably looking at potential government workers looking at helping with the book deal. Mike, who was was Alan Hevesy?
He was the state comptroller, and as he was being reelected back in the early 2000s, it came out that he was also getting his wife chauffeured around, taken on shopping trips, and there was a lot of other personal tasks that were being handled by his staff, and he got taken down for it. He was basically ended up pleading guilty in a case and left office. And that's when our current comptroller, Tom DiNapoli, was appointed by the legislature how he got to be there. And then he's been reelected many times.
The one thing I'll say about the Cuomo staff is that they are all veterans and they have all worked on his campaigns before. And when there's a campaign going on, you have to keep a firewall on what time am I spending on the campaign? What time am I spending on the government? And I imagine that they probably implemented a lot of those practices while they were working on the book. No question, this is going to be a political problem for Cuomo. I wonder whether it will ever become a real legal problem for him. He has been investigated by the feds in the past, by Preet Bharara, and they chose not to charge him with anything.
Rosemary?
I don't know. I'm not the best person on the panel to speak about Cuomo. State government is not my expertise. As a voter, I don't understand why the Republicans aren't taking advantage of this and finding someone really kick-ass to run against him, because I'm not seeing it, and I would still vote for Andrew Cuomo if he were to run tomorrow.
So, Rosemary, name one.
We were just talking about Chris Gibson in the break.
Oh, he's terrific, by the way, and I've talked to him about it. He's now a college president.
Right.
I think he likes being a college president, and I think he's going to, you know, stay with that. The obvious one would be the existent Attorney General Tish James, who I think
I don't think she can beat him. I'm sorry. There's too many disadvantages to.
By the way, I couldn't agree with you more. Yeah. I couldn't agree with you more. She cannot beat him. So let's go and find anybody else who's on the scene who is a traditional politician. Now, you might get, you know, I mean, every time we have this kind of thing. And by the way, the Republicans are putting up Trumpers to run against Cuomo. So, you know, you might get somebody of a Bloombergian type person, but he had a chance to run for governor and didn't want to do it. He wanted to be mayor. So unless you find a Nelson Rockefeller type, he's dead, but a Nelson Rockefeller type.
I'd vote for him.
Certainly a downside.
Well, a lot of us would vote for him for a lot of reasons, which we needn't get into right now. But, you know.
Keep going, Alan.
A Democrat or Republican, who could take on Andrew Cuomo and beat him in either a primary in the Democrat side or as a straight-on Republican opponent? I don't think it's going to be a Trumper in New York State. It's going to be someone who's right close to being a liberal Republican, like a Rockefeller Republican, and there ain't many of them around. Mm-hmm.
And so we all focus.
So why do they take a right-wing Republican congressman and a Trumper and solidify around him for the same reason that they're doing it in Congress and every other place? They're scared to death of Trump. So therefore, they take a totally unwinnable guy to run for governor.
I mean, and really two of them, both Giuliani and Zeldin, right? I mean, you get like...
Well, Giuliani's a joke. That's forget.
Well, they used to say that about Trump. Ah!
They said that about Carl Palladino, and he got the nomination.
Yeah, and he did, and he lost.
And he was a joke.
Where's Andrew O'Rourke? All right.
Andrew Patrick O'Rourke. I remember that. Yeah, against Mario.
That's right. So Ed is basically echoing what you all are saying in his letter. How can our own autocrat Andrew Cuomo be derailed? Most direct answer is via Democratic primary. But who to run? Suppose AG Tish James decides to remain in her current post. Who are other credible Democratic candidates? How about WAMC panelist David Soares? Black, Hispanic, solid, moderate, extremely intelligent, good people skills, including great sense of humor. David could bury both. Could carry both downstate and up.
Wait.
I've already forwarded this to David, by the way. But go ahead.
Wait. There is an invisible ink in the New York State Constitution. There's a provision that says you can't be a statewide officer unless as a Democrat. Unless you come from the five boroughs of Manhattan, of New York.
Right.
It's a little joke there. Get it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think history is on your side.
Mm-hmm. And David still has, that Boston accent, the Rhode Island accent, so I don't know.
How about Tom DiNapoli, Alan? You know, you have a lot of praise for our current comptroller.
There are a lot of people who think Tom DiNapoli would be very, very good. I love the guy. He's my favorite of all the people that I know in New York State politics. He's my favorite. Nevertheless, he's not a politician. You know what I mean?
He's not a household name, I guess.
Yeah.
Unless you're a state worker, and then he signs your pension check.
So you say as a state worker, it's not enough. Yeah.
So you go through it, name after name after name. There's not a person that even comes within a whisper of even getting close to challenging Andrew Cuomo. He would, any one of these names, he would dismantle them vigorously and enjoy it. And so you go forward. I think it's hard to see anybody else being governor in 2022 other than Andrew Cuomo.
I admit, and I find this very unlikely, but let's just say he's impeached. Then what?
He runs again.
Will he be removed from office?
If he's removed from office,
is New York law like federal that you can't run again?
It's an interesting nuance. Maybe they do have the ability to, the legislature would have the ability if they impeach you, convict you, remove you from office, they could also bar you from future office, perhaps.
There's a whole bunch of newbies. In Democratic politics, younger guys, younger people, men, women, and who want him out of there so they can just get moving up. And, I'm telling you now, they are out for blood. So it's possible that they'll impeach him. But I think you'd really have to sleep, as I've said many times, with your eyes open and the lights on if you were going to do that.
You know, and even when I was struck by your interview with, and correct me if I get this wrong, Alan, but yeah, you, in your interview with Chuck Schumer, Chuck said, yeah. I still stand by my yeah, thought no, that he should be removed from office.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing about Andrew. I know the guy fairly well. And if you're not him, you're not really good. So that's just the way it is. Schumer's a tough guy. Andrew's a tough guy. I don't know. I think some of those guys may have been a little precipitous in getting out ahead. But Schumer sure did. Gillibrand wasn't there, that's for sure. So doing it. So, you know, what can I say? They were all lined up. Heave-ho. But he's tough. Boy, he's tough.
Just a quick plug that second part of Alan's interview with Chuck Schumer will be happening in just about 2 or 3 minutes. We have a couple of minutes for more letters. Got a lot of letters today, so getting to as many as we can. Russell said someone on your panel just slipped in the absurd notion that the U.S. had no immigration law until the 1960s. What?
No, along the border with Mexico, there was not restrictions on who could come over. They certainly had immigration laws. We kept out Japanese, and we kept out
exactly the
Eastern
point of the
Europeans.
Letter.
Yeah.
You are so good. All right.
Chinese.
Chinese, of course. Yeah.
But still, in the country's history, there's a big chunk of time in which there were no laws, even against the so-called Orientals at the time. Those were the first ones that came in.
David Soares just wrote back and said, I'm in now. If I could only get Alan's dog's endorsement, I'd be all set. There you go.
He can have my endorsement. I think he's terrific. Hello, I think he's terrific.
David,
I still have to go over to Albany.
David will be on Friday. Let's see. Ted writes to us about the Alzheimer's drug. Alzheimer's is torture. How about a death with dignity law? We watched my mother deteriorate. It was hell and didn't have to be that way. And certainly
absolutely
something
right.
That is much... in much discussion in this state and across the country. Also, we go to, I'm so tired of catastrophic failures in Democratic messaging and marketing against the GOP machine, says Wendland. Yeah. It seems that Democrats are repeatedly forced to fail by a lockstep refusal of GOP and inept public communication on the moderate and progressive citizens of the country. I see no useful path, just like when McConnell obstructed during Obama years. I read The Color of Compromise, and there are limits to one side being forced to always do the compromising while another represses votes. I think that'll be the last word on the program this morning.
My thanks
to our wonderful panel, Alan Shartok. Alan, thank you. Rosemary and JP and Mike, thank you all. Wonderful to see your faces here. Up next, Alan talking to Chuck Schumer. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.